Hello and welcome to HN Pod, your daily dose of the top stories from Hacker News. Today is November 2nd, 2025, and this is episode number 203.
It's great to be here. On the show today, we're celebrating a milestone for Linux gaming as it finally crosses the 3% mark on Steam. Then we'll dive into why your URL is one of the most powerful and overlooked state management tools you have.
After that, we'll look at some notes from the legendary DJ B, who's been experimenting with PhilC, a memory-safe C compiler, and is trying to rebuild Debian with it. We'll also revisit a classic 2016 article from Andre Karpathy on why backpropagation is a leaky abstraction.
And finally, we'll check out Tongyi Deep Research, a new open-source 30 billion parameter mixture of experts model from Alibaba that's aiming to compete with OpenAI's research agents. Let's get started.
First up, the year of the Linux desktop has been a running joke for decades, but for gamers, it seems to be getting closer to reality. Gaming on Linux reports that for the first time, Linux users have crossed the 3% mark in the Steam Hardware and Software Survey for October 2025.
3% might not sound like a lot, but the trend is what's important here. Windows usage is down by 0.75%, while Linux is up 0.41%, and even macOS saw a little bump. This translates to millions of active users. The article credits the end of Windows 10 support and, of course, the massive success of the Steam Deck.
Looking at the distribution breakdown is fascinating. SteamOS Holo, the OS on the Steam Deck, makes up over 27% of that Linux share. But what's really interesting is what follows. Arch Linux is at over 10%, and then you have a mix of Linux Mint, KatchiOS, and various Ubuntu flavors. It shows that while the Deck is the gateway drug, a diverse ecosystem of desktop users is also growing.
The Hacker News comments really capture the sentiments of people making this switch. User TaxiShot shared their story of moving from Windows to Linux Mint for both development and gaming. They were tired of Windows performance issues, like a laggy React-based start menu and mysterious memory leaks. Now they're running Overwatch on Linux with comparable FPS to Windows.
And that comment immediately kicks off a classic Linux debate. Someone replies that Linux Mint, by being based on older packages, is going to sabotage the momentum Linux is having. This is the eternal tension in the Linux world, the desire for a stable, it-just-works experience versus needing the latest drivers and kernels for cutting-edge hardware and gaming performance.
Exactly. The comments section on the article itself is a microcosm of this, with users debating the merits of Mint stability versus a rolling release like Arch, or something in between like Debian testing. It really highlights that Linux isn't one thing, and finding the right fit is part of the journey. But the bigger picture is that thanks to Valve's work with Proton, the "I can't switch because of games" argument is weaker than it has ever been.
Right. One commenter even brings up the old joke about the year of the Linux Windows, where Microsoft eventually just puts a Windows user interface on top of the Linux kernel. With things like WSL, it feels less like a joke and more like a plausible, if distant, future. For now, though, seeing that number tick past 3% is a huge win for platform diversity in PC gaming.
Our next story is a fantastic piece from the Alfie blog titled URLs are State Containers. It's a wonderful reminder of a fundamental web feature that modern front-end development sometimes forgets. The author recounts finding an old URL in their code for Prism.js, a syntax highlighting library. The URL wasn't just a link to the download page, it contained the entire configuration. Themes, languages, plugins, all encoded in the parameters.
It's one of those aha moments. We get so wrapped up in complex state management libraries like Redux or ZooStand, but the URL has been doing this job since 1991. It gives you shareability, bookmarkability, and a working back button for free. As the author says, if you refresh the page and lose your state, you've probably put that state in the wrong place.
The article does a great job breaking down the different parts of the URL for state management. You have path segments for hierarchical data, like user profiles. You have query parameters for filters, sorting, and options. Think of any e-commerce site. And you have the anchor fragment for client-side state, which was the original basis for single-page app routing.
The Hacker News comments are full of developers who feel this pain deeply. The top comment from Joral17 says, "I genuinely don't understand why people don't get more upset over hitting refresh on a web page and ending up in a significantly different place. It's mind-boggling and actually insulting as a user." And I couldn't agree more. It breaks the fundamental user expectation of how the web works.
There's also a great discussion about the practical challenges. One is that if you update the URL for every little state change, you can pollute the browser history. The solution there is to be thoughtful about using history.pushState versus history.replaceState. For something like a search as you type input, you'd want to replace the history entry, not create a new one for every keystroke.
Another thread points out that this often becomes a blind spot in the development process. Product managers specify features, designers create mockups, and developers implement them, but no one is explicitly designated as the owner of the URL structure. It's a UX issue that often falls through the cracks, leading to these frustrating, unshareable web experiences. This article is a great call to action to treat the URL as a first-class citizen in application design.
Next up, we have a post from Daniel J. Bernstein, better known as DJB, titled Notes by DJB on Using Filsi. For those who don't know, DJB is a giant in the fields of cryptography and security, so when he takes a deep dive into a new technology, people pay attention.
And he's clearly impressed. Filsi is a memory-safe C and C++ compiler. The goal is to take existing C code, which is notoriously prone to memory errors like buffer overflows, and compile it in a way that provides memory safety guarantees. DJB notes that many libraries and applications he's tried work under Filsi without any changes.
His selfish objective, as he puts it, is to protect the machines he manages by switching them over to code compiled with Filsi. He's even started a project to rebuild Debian packages with Filsi, which he's tentatively calling Filian. That is a monumental undertaking and a huge vote of confidence in the project.
He also provides some performance benchmarks. He found that code compiled with Filsi is typically between 1 and 4 times slower than the same code compiled with Clang. That's a noticeable performance hit. But for many applications, a 4x slowdown in exchange for eliminating an entire class of critical security vulnerabilities is a trade-off many would be willing to make.
The resource requirements to build Filsi itself are also pretty steep. DJB mentions that on his 12GB RAM machine, the build kept failing until he added 36GB of swap space. A comment on Hacker News points out that this is likely due to the LLVM linker, which is famously memory hungry during the final link step.
The discussion on Hacker News naturally turned to how this compares with languages like Rust, which are designed for memory safety from the ground up. One commenter wondered if you could achieve the best of both worlds by writing new code in Rust, but linking against legacy C libraries compiled with Filsi. However, another user pointed out that Filsi's approach to tracking pointer provenance might make a traditional foreign function interface, or FFI, very difficult or even impossible. It's a fascinating project that tackles one of the oldest and most persistent problems in software security.
Our next article is a classic from 2016 by Andre Karpathy, but it's just as relevant today. It's called Backpropagation is a Leaky Abstraction. Karpathy argues that while modern deep learning frameworks automate the process of backpropagation, you can't just treat it like a magic black box if you want to be effective at building and debugging neural networks.
The leaky abstraction idea is that the underlying mechanics of how the network learns, by calculating gradients and propagating them backward through the layers, have unintuitive consequences that can bite you if you're not aware of them. He gives several great examples.
The first is vanishing gradients with sigmoid activation functions. If your initial weights are too large, the neurons can saturate, meaning their output is always close to 0 or 1. In that state, the local gradient is almost 0, so no learning signal gets passed back to the earlier layers, and your network just stops training.
Another one is dying ReLUs. ReLU is a very common activation function that's 0 for any negative input. If a neuron's weights get updated in such a way that it never activates for any input in your training data, its gradient will always be 0, and it becomes permanently dead, like irrecoverable brain damage for your network.
The Hacker News comments feature a really insightful bit of nuance. User Niranor points out that the problem isn't really with backpropagation itself, which is just an efficient algorithm for computing derivatives. The problem is with gradient descent as an optimization strategy. The fact that zero gradients halt learning is a feature of the optimizer, not a bug in how the gradients were calculated. It's a subtle but important distinction.
Absolutely. The post is a great reminder that even as our tools get more powerful and abstract away more complexity, a foundational understanding of what's happening under the hood is still essential for troubleshooting. As Karpathy says, if you just believe that TensorFlow or PyTorch will magically make them work, you'll be completely lost when they don't.
And for our final story, we're looking at a big new release in the open source AI space. The Tongye Lab at Alibaba has introduced Tongye Deep Research, a 30 billion parameter mixture of experts model that they claim rivals OpenAI's Deep Research agent.
This isn't just a standard chatbot. A deep research agent is designed for complex, multi-step tasks. It can browse the web, synthesize information from multiple sources, and generate detailed reports. The team is not just releasing the model, but also their entire methodology for creating it, which is a huge contribution to the community.
A key part of their methodology is the heavy use of synthetic data. They've built a system called Agent Founder that essentially creates a data flywheel. It uses the outputs and trajectories from previous model runs to generate new, high-quality training data for continual pre-training and fine-tuning. This approach is becoming a major trend, as it's a way to scale up data generation without relying solely on expensive and slow human annotation.
The Hacker News discussion raises a really interesting strategic question. Are we going to see an explosion of these highly specialized, purpose-trained models? Or will the giant frontier models from places like OpenAI and Google just absorb these new training techniques and remain dominant? One commenter pointed out that GPT 3.5 was surprisingly good at chess, but newer, more aligned models seem to have lost that ability, suggesting that there's a real trade-off between general capability and specialized skill.
There's also a healthy dose of skepticism in the comments. User T. Bruckner asks if anyone actually finds these research tools useful in practice, saying that in their experience, they generate really bland reports that don't go much deeper than a search engine summary.
And that's a fair criticism. Others replied that while the final output might be bland, the tool is very useful for the initial discovery phase of research, finding sources, identifying key terms, and getting a broad overview of a topic you know nothing about. It's not a replacement for critical thinking, but a powerful assistant for it. It seems we're still figuring out the best ways to integrate these powerful new tools into our workflows.
And that brings us to the end of episode 203 of HN Pod. The stories we discussed today are all available on Hacker News, and we'll have links in the show notes.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the top stories from Hacker News.